Narwhal has been around for 30 years, and it's a very interesting, exciting time for the organisation. We're going to talk to their CEO today and have a discussion around how Narwhal is not just a female organisation, but an equitable organisation throughout the entire industry. Let's dive on in. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us today on the Quadcast. Now, Catherine, you are the CEO of Narwhal, but we're going to have a bit of a chat about your overall career and history and some fantastic conversations about what Narwhal's doing and what it represents and some great stats into the industry and where you're looking to obviously influence the industry as well. So, Catherine, tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and what led you to be the CEO of Narwhal.
Yeah, thanks. Firstly, thank you for having me, Seton. I'm delighted to be on. So a little bit about my background. I started my legal career as a lawyer in a top-tier practice doing construction work, so commercial contracts, big infrastructure adjudications, you know, risk allocation for contractors and so on. Got this really good understanding of what goes wrong at the back end when we don't get things right up front.
So important.
But then realizing I didn't quite fit the box of a top tier lawyer and a budding advocate, I really wanted to do court work at the time. I then moved into mid tier and then later a boutique law firm and got to cut my teeth in court work. So worked on much broader contractual employment law and equity disputes and property disputes. And I was in court, you know, on a regular, at least weekly basis. I pretty much quickly worked out that I could help one client resolve a dispute or access justice, but I could actually have a much bigger impact if I could fix the law and the systems behind why those disputes arose in the first place. So I moved into government regulation, spent about 7 years across utilities, resources and building, eventually as a deputy CEO and dealing a lot with legislative reform, briefing ministers, reviewing cabinet decisions as an independent performance auditor and things like that. So got a really good insight into government and government, I think, genuinely wants to do the right thing, but really needs industry to help them do that by bringing the solutions and making sure they're based on evidence. So from there, I moved into a peak body representing, it was about 1,600 construction businesses at the time. I did advocacy, industry support, legislative reform in areas like procurement, payment security, industrial relations, work health and safety, all the things that really impact our sector from whatever angle you come to the sector from.
Yeah.
And I got to see what our members really relied on. And that's, you know, it's legal, it's technical building, safety, industrial relations, contracts. I was appointing adjudicators and arbitrators to resolve disputes, got to work in industry body coalition. So got to set up a huge coalition of actually 39 industry bodies around industrial relations and work health and safety reform, and got to see, and that covered construction, transport, agriculture, health. In the end, we had hospitality and aged care joining us. So really showed for me the power of, I guess, collective voice in changing the systems and the law that we're operating under. Then we had a big family move. We moved to the UK and I worked in a sustainability business doing the people side of sustainability. So that was working with some major clients and contractors, organisations like Network Rail, National Highways, Lendlease, BAM, Skanska, HS2, and mainly around cultural and commercial sustainability. And the organisation I worked with actually ran a large diversity benchmarking study, the biggest that's ever been conducted, I'm aware of, globally. Over 500,000 employees represented from about 550 or so organisations, and really highlighted for me, you know, the workforce and culture challenges in construction are actually global. They're not just Australian. Yeah. And there's a lot of synergies between what I've seen over my career in Australia and overseas.
So I look forward to unpacking that a bit more.
Yeah, it's a really interesting area, actually. Returned from Australia, heard someone pass this role across my desk, the inaugural CEO of Narwhal. Genuinely, I got excited. I've been involved with NAHWIC before as a judge and just generally as a member. I really believe strongly in what they did. Mm. NAHWIC is the National Association of Women in Construction. We are a fantastic movement. We've got nearly 20,000 members now. We've got chapters in every state and territory. And we've got this incredible volunteer base. We are volunteer-led and very proudly so. We've got about 400 volunteers around the country doing the work that NAHWIC delivers. Yeah. So I got to come on board at what was a really critical time for the organisation. It was our 30th anniversary year last year. And there was this real opportunity to really step into a national advocacy voice, a really true national advocacy voice. I guess my passion for changing the systems and policy is right where I'm at now.
And that makes a lot more sense now, understanding your background and what you've done as well within that. Okay, all right. Well, that's so tell us a little bit, as you said, NAHWIC's been around for 30 years. There's obviously been a lot that's happened in those 30 years. It's become something that's probably unrepresented. I think it's changing. I mean, NAHWIC's quite well represented as an organisation, but as females in the industry, you think of that 30 years, how it sort of emerged. And now, you know, there's so many fantastic women in the industry doing fantastic things. And I was just thinking the other day how it's just so dramatically changing. I've just come back from an event where, and even now in reaching out to leaders, it's like nearly 50-50 in some areas of the industry, and others it's very different when we're talking about senior leadership. So tell us a little bit about NAHWIC and where it's sort of at the moment. And now obviously having a CEO appointed really takes that organisation to the next level, what it's looking to do.
Yeah, sure. So we are, as you say, 30 years young. We're the peak body for women in construction. So we've got membership with both individuals and organisations, and we've got currently 392 organisational members. So we cover right across the sector from top tier through to sole traders, across every market segment, across resi, commercial infrastructure, you name it. Also property and utilities represented, the professions, all of the trades. So we're unique in that we're an organisation that represents the entire industry. And because of the reach of our volunteers and our membership, we've got boots on the ground understanding of what's happening right around the country. Our vision is simple, and we reset this when I came on board. We want an equitable construction industry for everybody. So we recognise that in doing that, that's how we're going to achieve much greater representation and advancement and contributions from women. So our work that we do spans advocacy, culture change programs, and the usual member services that you might know NAHWIC for. Mm. So things like mentoring, scholarships, legal advice, networking, and probably increasingly policy reforms at the highest level of government. Mm. So we're different in that we're not just a support network for women. Obviously, that's an important component of what we do. But we are also a genuine agent of really trying to push the change that we need across the sector. And we're doing that with both the industry directly and industry-led forums and through our membership and our insights and our research. And we're also doing that with ministerial and departmental access.
Yeah. So I obviously am quite aware you guys have done some pretty amazing surveys and studies, I think particularly last year. Do you want to tell us a bit about some of those and what's come out of those as well?
Yeah, sure. So one of the surveys we released last year, or reports rather, we worked with the University of Sydney to deliver a big report around parental leave and return to work experiences for women. Mm. And that was a massive piece of work, and it was funded by Infrastructure New South Wales through their Women in Construction program. And that funding allowed us to really look and do a deep dive into the experience of women, including in on-site roles in construction, which is not very well understood. And ultimately, we found that the single biggest risk point for attrition across the sector of women who are into their careers is actually pregnancy. And the fact that organisations don't have in place the policies, the procedures and the ways of operating to actually accommodate not only accommodate people coming back from parental leave, but really to see them thrive and support them through those early stages of parenthood. So one of the findings is also that we do need to see more men taking up parental leave to really make sure that we're seeing parental leave as a parenting problem rather than a gender problem.
Yeah.
Obviously, women have babies. We've been having them for a long time and will continue to do so. It shouldn't be something that halts a woman's career. It really should be something we can be factoring in as part of our workforce planning and our career development for women.
Absolutely. And I think we've seen, I've touched different parts of the industry, and I think there's two parts. There's the part of first being able to provide it, right, parental leave and whatever, whether it's paid or unpaid or what that looks like. So obviously the government and what the government provides is the minimum. And then there's the cultural element too of what people feel like it is. And we're having this conversation actually at an event I was at on the weekend, and that it's great to see, why are we losing, and this was for architects, why are we losing so many, the question was the 30 under 30, so it came from emerging leaders. Why is it that what is the industry doing to see this amount of women leaving the industry? And I sat there, obviously, because I talked to lots of people and I also run HR for companies as well. And there's two real elements that it is, because even offering it, and then when you're doing this from an HR perspective, you're looking at what's the cost, what's the return? There's a lot of money, particularly once you start to get to a part, and depends how much that you're doing. And then there's that cultural element. And by the cultural element, I mean that's one that's in the organisation of that it's actually okay that we expect that our males are going to take that time off in the same way that we would support our females. And by the way, I have a female partner, so I was the second parent and I did in a different way in that way. So I think we always have to be careful too, not to just make it purely a gender, but a two-parent situation as well. And the thing is, though, then it's the other part of that once you actually come back from parental leave, what are we actually doing to support that person or those people in that situation? Because in essence, I see a lot of women leaving the industry on two other elements, that they come back and there's not really flexibility.
Yeah,
and they just get absolutely burnt out because they just can't find that right part. Or there's the same thing too, is it okay for a male to go to 4 days a week to be able to take their kids and to be able to do that? That's on the person themselves, but it's also what they do and they perceive in the organisation. Is that actually okay for me to do? So we're always in that element. Doesn't matter, we can do things, and as you would look on a policy point of view, from a government point of view, there's putting things in place and there's actually how it operates. I'll give a bit of a similar example. It's like we have all these psychosocial laws in place that actually, if somebody puts in a mental health claim, it's actually the system isn't set up to support them to do that. So it's kind of this thing of some people think, well, let's just put this in place, this will solve all our problems. But actually, you've got to systematically keep asking people, why are they leaving? What is that happening? And being open to look at continuously working on it.
Yeah. And importantly, taking the lessons from why people are leaving and putting initiatives in place to stop that happening. So it's so many things in what you've just said came out in our research. Firstly, it's the uptake and parental leave policies that distinguish between, we still have some that are maternity and paternity leave. Now that's obviously doesn't work for a lot of families, mm-hmm. and it doesn't work for what we're trying to achieve in strong parenting bonds across families too. And we've got single parents, we've got same-sex families, we've got different arrangements for families, okay. And parental leave needs to accommodate all different types of families and not be a binary construct. It's not a binary construct. Then we've got the men feeling able to ask for it and actually getting what they need when they do ask for it. And the experience of men there can really differs. So picking up on what you've said, often women will have a different response when they ask for flexibility on return to work to men. And there is still that expectation that men won't need to be caring as much as, their partners. And of course that that also puts into perspective, we're not accounting for different types of families. We have seen some really great stuff done on this, though. So, you know, it's as simple as running a program where John Holland, for example, ran a program where they had an early start and a late start group, and they split the day so that those that needed to could start early but then go and pick up children or sort out daycare or elder care responsibilities, whatever it is that they needed to factor into their life.
Absolutely.
And those that had to do daycare or school drop-offs could also do that and then come to work. And we're one of the very few sectors that expects people to be on site at 6 or 7 a.m. There's not many daycare centres that open at that time, and certainly not schools. And if you're trying to juggle drop-offs and pick-ups, it just makes it impossible. So there's a fundamental structural flaw with how the sector operates if we're trying to actually attract and retain women into the sector, because a lot of women are burdening those responsibilities. And
continue, please.
So there's so much in this, and when we start to unpack, just, you know, when I say to people, parental leave and parenting, becoming a parent or becoming pregnant before you become a parent is the single biggest risk factor of losing women in construction, they're quite shocked, because I don't think there's an understanding of just how difficult that is if you are the first. And our research found many women in on-site roles are literally the first person to be taking parental leave, the first person to be pregnant on site. So they're navigating a system with managers and a team that have never dealt with it before, aren't very well trained in it. That culture piece comes in, because you could have the best policy, but unless your direct line reporting manager or the team that you work with actually understand that and believe in it and are trained in it, it doesn't necessarily mean a good experience. So we've had lots of women giving us incredible eye-watering experiences through this research, and we published a lived experience report as part of it. So highly recommend going and having a read. It's a really sobering read and a real pulse check on the sector. But that link between the experience, even from having the right PPE, being able to keep doing your site-based role, many women are moved into administrative functions from either trade or engineering backgrounds, where that's not what they want to be doing in their career. Understandably, that's not what they have chosen to do. There's a lot of failure to accommodate. Even when we look at toileting facilities, we still have sites without equitable facilities. The fact that we don't have toilets on site
I'll give you a lived experience there. So my partner has worked in construction, is a general manager for construction, and worked in facility managers, worked in the industry for years as well. And so walked into an organisation and, you know, being females there, and was like, the owner's like, what's this for? She's like, there's no sanitary bins. You've had no sanitary bins here for this long. And then on site would get questions from blokes like, oh, I just don't understand. Like, once a month, she just keeps just going off and like having, she's like, have you thought about this in some way? So it is 100% correct. There isn't a lot of the time these really basic things that a female will think about may not be things that other people are thinking about, right? Or may not realise what this looks like. I mean, obviously, as an HR person, I sit there and I go, okay, well, we've got two factors here when we've got on site, right? We need to be able to make that sure that person is safe for obviously our WHS side of things. But at the same time, it's how it's handled. I remember being part of an organisation where somebody was very much in a safe role and they were like, no, you've got to go off and get, you know, medical certificates to prove that you're still capable of working. It's like, look, there's a risk profile there and doing, and then there's also working with the person as well and actually supporting them in that. And you don't want any female to feel like having a baby is some bad thing.
Yeah.
That they need to. It needs to be something that they're supported in. And how can we help you to continue to do your job as your body changes throughout this? And even post-pregnancy, you know, that can take weeks and months to change. How can we help you? And I look at it in the same way, and maybe it's the wrong terminology, but, you know, with like return to work, it's like you can either make it really complicated or you can literally just work with somebody and work out what can we do to help you. In the same way somebody sprained their ankle, what can you do? What can't you do? What can we help you with to be able to help you to do that as well.
And some of it's just a conversation. The number of people who've come to me and said, I don't know how to manage this. I have, you know, someone's just announced they're pregnant. What do I do? And I say, well, have you spoken to them? And they're in their head, they're going through, oh, well, I'm going to have to put them on different duties. I'm going to have to do this. I'm going to have to do that. Then they'll take this long of leave. And I say, hang on, have you spoken to them? Because there's a lot of assumptions that go along with pregnant and having a baby. And that shouldn't be happening. We should be having conversations with people to understand what are their career goals, what are their family goals. Also flexibility in that that may change once you have a baby. It's a huge life-changing event. But that simple, I'm not sure when it comes to pregnancy and parental leave, that common sense goes out the window. You know, just have the conversation. Don't assume that that person is going to do it in a particular way, because there's many different ways to parent, many different ways to come back to work, many different timeframes that people are ready to come back to work for whatever reason. But that conversation and actually asking the person first is a really good starting point.
And it's just basic things. Like when we do this, we just sit down with people and go, what are you thinking? We know it's going to change. You could plan. We're going to keep having conversations with you. We'll get a rough plan. Things could change as you go along because pregnancies and things change. But it's just about checking in. I do understand from businesses trying to look around resourcing and what they're thinking. But again, you have that conversation with people of what they're thinking and are those plans changing? You can make those changes. I mean, my partner had the same presumption as well. You know, it was presumed, oh, you can take off 12 months. No, I'm going to be back. We're lucky enough to be able to plan us. I'll be back in 6 weeks. You know I spoke to somebody the other day, not in this industry, who was bloody working after 3 days after having kids. My mother had me and went back to work after 2 days. So everybody has a different experience and everybody makes different choices and everybody has a different family set up as well. And you're right, we can't make those presumptions. But like yourself, the simplest advice I can give to anybody is just have a conversation. It's literally the easiest thing to do. But it's the same way as you ask somebody, you know, and this is where regular check-ins and things like that happen. Actually asking somebody, how are you going? Where is it? What are you feeling? You've also got to ask yourself, if you're a bunch of males directors and you're wondering why people aren't raising, literally asking the question, whether it's through surveys, whether it's through people who are leaving, whether it's those who are aspiring, what is it they see are the challenges or the things that are stopping them? And then we just start to unpack those and do that. So, I mean, there's lots of other elements. But I think, Catherine, as you've said, though, this conversation isn't just about females. This is about making it equitable for all. This is an overall diversity, inclusion conversation because, like, you know, the universal design, if we design it for some, we're going to be including others. And so, you know, I'm a massive advocate in the neurodiversity side of things. Cultural diversity as well is just as important. And so we'll see, yes, the experiences may be slightly different, but I suppose the same assumptions and the same principles around leadership and working with people doesn't fundamentally change.
Yeah, it's the fundamental basics of being an inclusive leader. It requires you to know to speak to know and to understand your people and what they need and want. And that's not to say you give everyone in your business everything they want, but it's to understand, you know, your job as a leader is to get the most out of your people. Firstly, you need to understand what their capabilities are. Secondly, you need to understand what motivates them. And thirdly, you need to understand what are the impediments that they might face that prevents them from doing their best work. And then when you know all of those things, you can actually work together to set up the environment so that they can succeed. So it is, as you've said, it's the same whether you're dealing with someone from a particular religious background who needs certain accommodations to be able to practice their religion, or those who are neurodivergent who might need different accommodations to be the best they can be in the workplace. It's the same if you're supporting a man who, and we hope to see more men taking parental leave, because that's one of the ways that we're going to actually support women is to make sure that more men are actually making use of it. Not only can their partners, or whether that's in same sex or heterosexual relationships, can work in the way that they need to, but also they get to experience that, you know, parenting and being an active father in their child's life, which is enormously valuable for the entire community, let alone that family. So that's it's a bigger picture, long-term game that we're playing here.
Oh, there is, and then let alone super and all of these elements. I mean, look, anybody who's put together a parental leave policy to a company that doesn't have one, this is all the research that we pull out, that we actually show, you know, from there's numerous amounts of studies, and I'm sure yours is another one. I think it is, it's interesting how it's just made it from an assumption that we would assume to quite clear as day. That, and that's very sad. So, and I think it's something that as an industry, we need to work on how we do support. I think there is pros. I mean, I have a family who, you know, we go to school with, and, you know, school starts at 9 o'clock in the morning and ends at 3. So mum works in property and she, you know, goes off and drops off kid and is in there by 9. Dad's an electrician, so he starts early, has had to change in shifts then to be able to pick up and change in jobs to be able to do that. So there is definitely, there is parts of being able to support. And I think there is actually a lot of pros because tradies do potentially have a lot more availability in starting early, as you said, to end early. But yeah. I think what you mentioned about John Holland, there's just really simple things that make things easy. Yeah. Our brains like certainty. We like to know what things are. So sometimes grouping two people in parts or on Monday, Tuesdays, I do this or writing it down somewhere makes it quite easy. Right, that yeah. they know when people are in, we know when we're going to connect, you know, doing meetings between those hours, being able to connect and do those elements. Look, again, we're doing very generalization here at the end of the day. The industry is incredibly diverse.
It sure is, yeah.
And the experience that one person will have in a consulting firm will be very different to the experience that they might have on site, which may be, and again, you could be working in the same typology, same type of business, but different leaders or different approach. And that experience, again, will be very, very different that you have as well.
But it's interesting just how like the principles are the same. Experience is different, but the principles are the same.
Yeah.
And, you know, we are still a sector that if we talk about representation, we're still sitting at 12.4% of women across the sector. That's nationally across the entire sector. Wow. When you look at trades, we're sitting at 3.4%. And many people will say, oh, but we've made inroads here. We've, you know, things have changed. Yes, they've changed, but actually we've gone down. We were sitting at 17% in 2006. So it is a longer term game, and there's a lot that needs to happen. There's a lot of elements to this, parental leave being one of them, flexibility another, you know, fixing the gender pay gap. All of these things go into it. But fundamentally, it comes back to the culture and the leadership and the accountability in the environments that you're operating in. And those are elements that we are actively trying to, yeah. to help people through and trying to train people around. Often you mentioned people come to you and say that they're pregnant. Often people don't know what to do at that stage, and their response can really impact the person's experience of announcing their pregnancy. So there's a lot that we can be doing in terms of training people to be ready for those conversations. The same goes for dealing with sexual harassment or bullying or harassment claims. Many people aren't prepared for someone to come to them. And given that one in three women across the community experience sexual harassment, this is going to happen to you, whether it's a friend or a colleague or someone in your family or community. Yes. People just aren't ready for those conversations. So it's an area where we're really looking to upskill people to be able to be active listeners and good support people, and then be able to make sure that they are then referring a person to the right channels to get trauma-informed response yeah. to that. But there's that initial element which will impact whether a person does continue to speak about that or does raise issues or just leaves the company altogether. And we see far too much of that happening. And, another big area of change, a big campaign we've run around sexual harassment, gender-based violence, which is unfortunately rife in construction and something yeah. we really need to get a handle on.
I think you might have done a study on that last year. And I mean, I think this is the incredible thing is data doesn't lie. We have perceptions of what it is. But when you say that, you say, actually, we've lost more women out of the industry. We think we've made gains. Yeah. I must say, I sit here and I go, seriously? Oh my God, yeah. I thought we were actually yeah. improving. And you're telling me that we're going backwards.
Yeah.
Is
so if you just look at... Yeah, if you just look at apprenticeship stats, so and this is one of the key elements of why we say it's not all attraction. So we get women coming into trade apprenticeships, and by the end of their first year, the stats on that are 72% of them will have left. So by year two of a trade apprenticeship, you've already only left with 28%. So, and interestingly, the numbers aren't brilliant for men either. 61% of men who come into trade apprenticeship training leave before the end of their first year. Now, that is both a structural issue in terms of how we're running apprenticeships, but a big element of it is it's a culture issue. It's a retention factor. So we're able to attract those people into the sector, but we're not able to keep them. And these are young people. It's also experienced people coming into trade apprenticeships. That's a fundamental problem, a structural and inherent problem in the culture that we're expecting people to operate in. So we can't say it's anything but we need to change the way we're operating, because we literally won't fill the people gap that we've got, and we can't build the projects. We've got the pipeline. We can't build the houses we've committed to in any jurisdiction, and certainly not the infrastructure, the Olympic Games up here in Queensland.
Exactly. You know, this
workforce has to be a massive priority, and it has to get to the stage of implementing solutions. And we know what the issues are. We know exactly why women in particular are leaving. We've been doing this for 30 years. We really need more organisations and government to be taking that on board and really setting up their projects in a way that allows women to succeed on them.
So what are we doing at that trade level? Because obviously that's the biggest part in the industry right now. There's billions of dollars ready to be built. The biggest problem is we have hundreds of thousands of trades lacking to be able to build those people wanting to go into trades. Now you're saying even those entering, we're having such a high exit rate out of trades. What's actually being done on the ground level to actually improve?
Really great question. So NAHWEC is focusing on the elements that are going to build that culture change. So we've got a fantastic flagship program, Allyship in Action, which we won $5 million of federal grant funding through the Building Women's Careers Grant Program. And we won that early last year out of a competitive pool. So we're one of 10 large projects within that. There's also 10 smaller local projects. And that was funding across construction and other STEM industries, including renewables and other STEM science-based industries. Yeah. So we're very fortunate to be running a huge sector-wide culture transformation program, and it's genuinely unlike anything else that exists in the sector. And what probably makes it different is that we've got four programs within the project. A number of them are actually designed to bring men in as driving forces for change. So a lot of the programs we've focused on has been support for women, especially around apprentices, and there are fantastic organisations and programs in that space. But what we've been missing is really making sure that we're working with the 88% majority to change the culture that they have, they have the biggest input into. Mm. So something like, 90% of leaders in the sector are male. 88% of the sector is male. We have to be working as men, not as bystanders, but as active upstanders and drivers of equitable change. And part of that is also communicating just how important it is for them, and the fact that they benefit from that change. It's not this zero-sum game where women lose, women win and men lose. Actually, this is good for everybody, and it brings a stronger industry, and it makes an industry that's able to meet our deliverables a much better. And the reason we focus, so the first program in that is around male allyship. And the reason we focused on that is that the evidence shows, research shows, that men who are in allyship programs are actually three times more likely to advance gender equity. And we know that women with male allies are 70% more likely to advance in their careers. So we know it works both for the men and their understanding and how they approach things. It also works for women in terms of what they gain from that. But we have to start, we have to meet men where they are. We have to educate and support and call them in to be driving this change with us. So that's the first element of that exciting project. Yeah, we're also developing site-based resources and training for men. A little bit of a different approach. Rather than developing up the training that we know men need. We're actually going into those site-based environments, and we're underway at this at the moment. We're running focus groups with men to understand what they need, what are their views on this, how do we understand the male psyche so we can develop training and resources that actually meet their needs. And it's not a focus that has been big in the past. So we're trying to understand how we bring men on board, no matter where they are on their journey around equity and inclusion.
Yeah.
How do we bring them on to you know, care about this, understand it, and also then drive the change with us. So developing up a really exciting sort of global leading site-based program for men. Then we've got a sponsorship program where we're teaching men how to be sponsors and what sponsorship is and the accountability around that. And obviously sponsorship being very different from mentoring, we run mentorship programs across the country through NAWIC. We've done that for most of our existence. This is very much, it's not mentoring, it's not coaching. It is how do you actually really help promote women even when they're not in the room with you. So there's some big goals around that.
Yeah.
Delighted to say that when we went out for our first cohort for that pilot program we're building, we actually had more men signing up as sponsors than we had women signing up as sponsees.
Brilliant.
So we know that men, and that was targeted at senior men, so we know that men want to do this. They just need some help and understanding of how to do it, and also, I guess, also the confidence to know that This is part of their role. Many men stand back because they don't want to intervene. They don't want to be seen to be overtaking. They don't necessarily understand the full extent of just how powerful them being involved is, and how they need to be helping change men's behaviour, because it's a completely different element to it.
Well, I think that's probably a really good segue for some people who don't understand, because it comes up a bit at the moment, sponsorship versus mentorship. So do you want to just explain that in very simple terms so anybody listening can kind of understand it and why it's so vital?
Yeah, sure. So mentorship is largely focused around, if we're talking about men mentoring women, for example, it's largely focused around what the women need or what the mentee needs. So it's sort of a journey. It's learning from someone's experience. Your mentor will share, you might share some issues you're experiencing. Your mentor will share some learnings from their career and give you some ideas and support you. So it's more of an education and support tool for the mentee. Then when you look at sponsor, then there's coaching in between that to sort of bridge the gap between someone's experience and capabilities. But sponsoring is a whole, it takes that to the next level. So it's not necessarily about sort of divulging your experience and your tips and tricks and so on. It's actually about supporting people to advance them in their careers. So what we want to see is sponsors who are actively speaking a woman's name when she's not in the room, who are actively thinking about who could I be promoting, whether it's in my business or in my supply chain or even across the sector, and actually seeing their role as being one where they need to be taking that. As a senior leader, you need to be sponsoring people in your network. Who are you sponsoring? How much do they look like you? And where would you benefit from yeah. some diversity in those? So it's really trying to break down that, you know, who you know gets yeah. hired. And in construction, we are one of the sectors that still hires by who you know and you know, how much that person looks like you in terms of your background, your experience, and even, you know,
well, that would be the unconscious
race and gender.
Yeah. And sort of, I suppose, being aware of that. And thank you so much for sort of explaining that, because there's lots of conversations happening in organisations, the difference between mentoring and sponsorship and allyship and coaching. All of its very terms that are being thrown around, but trying to actually explain what that is and the importance of it. I think that when you explain it, what it is that you need to have people who are actually helping people to rise in the same way. So we're not just helping the same people rising, we're helping others as well.
Absolutely.
I think it's a great thing for leaders to really take on and have a bit of a think about, whether they're nominated to be a sponsor in a program or not. I think it's a really good thing for people to starting to think in their organisations, because people come to mentoring and I believe you can learn lots of things from different people, but it's when you've got somebody in your corner. And I suppose as that more senior person thinking, who are people that I see who I can lift up, who I can actually help and direct and be saying great things. And it's in those moments, as you said, it's the things that happen when somebody isn't in the room that are more powerful than what happens when people are in the room. Yeah. And so this element is very important. We have to be careful, obviously, with that. And that's why I like that. Just being conscious of how many of those people are you consciously or unconsciously sponsoring, and how much do they actually look like you, sound like you? Are you just replicating yourself, or do you see the benefits in diversity? And obviously there's enormous amounts of studies that diversity within our teams helps us to be a lot, helps organisations to be a lot better in their own performance. You know, we talked about this previously with the neurodiversity, is that even cognitive diversity, cultural diversity, a different way of looking things, different perception things. And I can tell you as a female who sits around boardrooms with lots of males, it can be a case of where you go, I'm going to choose how I'm going to say that, or how do I influence that? And I also know females who feel like they wouldn't normally have to act in a certain way, but when there's a room full of majority of men, they have to replicate some of those dominant behaviours to get be so feel like they're being heard or be able to put their point in. And I think that's the other point too, is that if you are sitting around a table, doesn't matter whether it's a female or what it isn't, making sure there are equal voices. And obviously now we're coming into more psychosocial health and And that's where it's really important too, that we're aware of these things. And we're hearing all these terms at the moment thrown around, but it's actually in very simple terms what that actually comes down to and what that means. And these little differences make a big difference as well.
And they're all interrelated. You know, the psychosocial safety is all about how you make your workforce or your workplace safe for people to be able to, you know, succeed in different ways. It's interrelated with mental health, interrelated with physical safety, interrelated with risk management. I'm putting my lawyer hat on here.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you would much rather know in, as a business, what's happening on the ground and where your risks are and what might end up in a court case, for example, that might exclude you from tendering for the next project before it comes up. So it's interesting, that cultural intelligence element that you've touched on is fascinating. My early career, my first degree was in an international relations and political science and an Asian language. And I lived in Japan for a while, and I love studying different cultures and how they interact and how they communicate and operate as a community. And I think probably a little part of that is I've brought into construction, because it is a community, albeit a very diverse one. And just understanding people and having that cultural intelligence, and that flows onto any of the protected characteristics that we've touched on, whether that's neurodivergence, cultural background, religion, age, disability. There's so many different elements, and there's so much intersectionality in people and the groups of people that you work with. You know, people don't just come as one thing. They all have lots of different backgrounds and experiences to bring. And that broad perspective, that's the value of diversity, right? Diversity is having the people in the room and making sure you're drawing from all those different experiences and perspectives. You know, the actual inclusion and equity bit is the next step. It's actually making sure that those people in the room not only have a voice, but actually are part of the decision making and actually get to actively contribute. They're not just in the room for the sake of being in the room. You know, that's a representation thing, but we need to go a whole lot further than that. And from an industry and a business perspective, it's about recognizing just how much better, you know, that makes your business. So we know that inclusive, you know, workplaces lead to better decisions. You know, something like 87% of the time, if you have a diverse team, it will make decisions 87% of the time, better decisions, and make them twice as fast. I mean, there's all this great research out there that shows you the huge value. And then there is a fiscal reality to this as well, because there is a direct business financial benefit of leading an inclusive culture and having that as how you run your business. So, and we even know there's great research out of my hometown in Perth, Western Australia, around that actually proved the causal link between women in leadership and actually business performance. So they looked at six different elements of business performance, from, you know, EBITDA and profit and value and so on. And they came to the conclusion that if you have women in leadership, senior leadership positions, you are much more likely to outperform your peers as a business. So there's actually no element where having women in your business and in senior leadership roles is a disadvantage. There's actually, in every single element, having an inclusive culture, having better representation on gender, but also on all those other elements, actually makes for better business success. So from a sustainability perspective of the sector.
It does need to be the same part. Whether it's a male or a female, that leader still needs to be, you know, good at active listening, good at promoting others, good at being able to do the same thing. And so it's looking for the right characteristics within people. Absolutely. Within the organisation. We had in a very early one of our podcasts, it was Chris Chevalier mentioned, I think it's a really, really good part where he said, you know, it's the culture, it's what you walk past is what you accept. So if you walk past somebody on site and you're, even if they're a site supervisor, the project manager, even if you're the CEO, you walk past and go, that wasn't okay. That's where it's about stopping and saying, hey, that type of conversation or the way we approach things is not appropriate and it's not in line with how we operate as a business. And it's actually sometimes in those micro moments of actually addressing things here versus having a policy. And we often talk about this. You and I might have a very similar, I've got a law degree and same thing, international and all these things. Looking at the macro and then coming down to the micro as well.
Yeah. How do you embed that?
Yeah. In those micro moments of where we actually say, it doesn't matter what our policies say in a corporate point of view or what it is from a government, it's actually what that looks like for that person, the experience that they're having. And as leaders, you have the biggest amount of influence. I talk about the culture is a living organism that's constantly moving and changing, and everybody is part of that. And it can shift and move. Leaders will ultimately have the most amount of influence on that. And the way that they work as leaders together, particularly when you're working professional services firms and other organisations, making sure that leadership is aligned and quite clear on its values, a bit like parents. You know, if one's saying one thing or another's the other, kids are just going to pick up. It's like, we need alignment. We need to be clear on what the values of this family or the values of this company are and what we accept and what we don't accept.
Yeah.
And those are the parts where, you know, you can. And the same thing, I think it's great. We've got, you know, new generations of people coming in who are going, well, I don't accept that. That's not okay. You know, like that comment where you just wolf whistled at me. I heard this the other day, somebody wolf whistled somebody with it and they jimmy. I'm like, sorry, I didn't mean to. I was like, I just sat there and laughed at it. Yeah, this still happens. And, you know, there's still things that happen, even at events.
And that generation coming in, I get really excited when I speak with the young people who are thinking about or joining our sector, because they have such ability and potential to actually drive the culture that we need, because we are going to run out of people to hire, right? They're our next generations of workers, and they're coming in and they are expecting something different. Mm. And this is... So I agree that leadership has the biggest pull on it, but we're also going from the ground up and training everyone in the sector. So the fourth and final program within our big $5 million project is actually a cultural ambassadors project. And that is around teaching everyone. So it's gender agnostic. It could be men, women, non-binary people. We're teaching everybody to be confident and competent to actually change behavior by knowing how to address it as it comes up. And that's lived experience. So that's every day on the site, as you see it, that, you know, standard you walk past, we're teaching people A, what the standard is, B, that it's not okay to walk past it, or that's not okay, and that's not what good looks like, and C, what they can actually do about it. So we're really trying to empower everyone in the workforce. Obviously, we want leaders through this program as well, but it's also built for those that might feel that they don't have power. But with this program and with their organization's support of it, that it's giving them some authority in being those cultural ambassadors on site and being someone who's able to say, that's not how we do things here. And that may be calling it out at the time, as you say it. It may also be having a quiet conversation separately, depending on the situation. So there's a lot of nuances in how we train people to be good cultural ambassadors. But it's really about making sure people understand that they have a role to play. Everyone is you know, impacts on culture, and everyone has a role to play in driving the culture that we need in construction, just for people to be okay, to support mental health, to support the best practice, to actually, you know, build what we build and maintain and look after and contribute to the built environment in ways that are safe and productive, and also meet all of our requirements around productivity, efficiency, cost savings, all the rest of it. So that's a really exciting element of what we're doing to try and shift that mindset.
Look, it looks like, you know, as an HR person, I think, great, you're hitting all elements on it. You've hit all angles on it. And that's it. You need to also understand, I like the focus groups too. You need to actually understand the mentality of who you're working with and what the barriers are to be able to rework that down. And I think, you know, as we said, I like what NAHWC's doing in regards to making equitable for all. This is not just a female conversation. We are talking the same elements in. Exactly. People being able to, you need to understand that what isn't okay, and actually saying that, whether, you know, I advise the same thing, you don't have to say it in that moment, but find the right moment or finding the right channels to say this has happened. So it is actually, yeah, it's a bit like revolutions, right? You know, it just doesn't start with one person. It starts with lots of little things and people not being okay with stuff and starting to move it. And I really think that we will start to see change. Do I think it's going to happen overnight? Do I think in 20 years' time the types of things are? We have probably a systemic culture within, particularly on site, it can be. But again, that's always dependent on which site and who's doing it. And at the end of the day, this is where tier one builders or lead contractors all the way down can actually have quite an impact on things. Anyway, Catherine, I'm just looking at the time. Thank you so much for everything. Now, we generally ask about podcasts and other things like that on the end of the podcast, but obviously, is there some resources that people should be checking out on NAHWC and getting involved in?
Yeah, a huge amount. So I'd say go to our website as a starting point, and that's nahwic.com.au. There you'll find our male allyship program, the first program in our big project, and that's open now for everyone to go through. We're particularly calling on men to complete that program. Interestingly, we have a lot of women and non-binary people also very interested and doing the program as well. But we've got an industry challenge on at the moment, so you can have a bit of healthy competition across the teams or your organisation, or even across jurisdictions, a bit of a state of origin, as the minister refers to. So have a look at what's on our website. We've got great research. We're doing some work around microaggressions. You'll find our report on microaggressions there.
Great.
Also building training around that. So there's a lot of education and training and resources being built at the moment, and lots of access to all of the things that can help you succeed in construction. And probably one big shout out is I'd love to see more men joining NAHWC. We are not a women's organisation. Obviously, we are trying to make the sector better for women, but that means it's making it better for everybody.
Yeah.
And our membership is open to all genders. So we warmly welcome men who want to come on this journey with us and recognise that how we're operating in construction at the moment, as a general rule, isn't quite working, and we have the power to change that. So come and join us and
just in a simple thing, if we could get that many more women into the industry, if our representation is that low, we're all trying to work out how we get more trades and how we get more people into the industry. It's it really calls out how vital this is, because it's attraction, but it's then retention. Seems to be the biggest part.
Absolutely. Retention is our big focus, and that's where we're going to see the biggest change. And I guess message is everyone listening, everyone has a role to play. So please come and we will meet you where you are. We understand that people are new to this. You may not understand the difference in terminology between allyship, mentoring, sponsorship. You know, we're designing our programs to meet everyone where you are and not expecting necessarily any background on this. It hasn't always been done well. The diversity and inclusion flag hasn't always been a simple one to understand or follow. So we're trying to shift that up and make sure that we bring everyone on the journey with us. And together I think we can really shift some things up.
Brilliant, great, and I love all of that. So thank you so much, and thanks for being on the program.
Thanks very much for having me, Seton. Wonderful to be here.
See you. What a fascinating chat. I must say, I was really taken back when I heard that we have actually gone back in our representation and not forwards. It really does sound, though, that NAHWIC is not just going to be an events organisation, it's now an advocacy organisation of how do we actually retain more females into the industry. And I really look forward to seeing what the impact of this organisation has on the next few years. Check out the show notes. There's going to be a lot of details in there.